Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is a man of many talents. He's a painter, a modeler, environmental artist, and much, much more. He's probably best known for his work on the Gears of War trilogy, Fallout 4, Fallout 76, and Starfield. His name is Joshua J. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you, man?
Good, man. Thank you so much for taking time out and doing this.
Yeah, no problem.
It's been a while to make this happen, but I'm glad we're here. Yeah. And we're doing it.
That was exciting.
Yeah. So just as a bit of an icebreaker.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently you and your wife are big Lord of the Rings fans, and you do Lord of the Rings marathons from time to time.
Oh, yeah. We have it running in the background fairly often.
So how many have you done, or how many times have you watched the films? And are they the normal OGs or the extended editions?
There's only the extended editions.
Ah, yeah. You're like Kurt.
Yeah.
Kurt's the same. He's like, no, the extended editions are the proper versions.
Oh, yeah. And I loved, like, Kurt was my guy, my go-to guy at Bethesda for nerding out. Like, to get, like if you wanted to really go into the weeds of, like, the Silmarillion, like, Kurt was your man. Like,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, he knows, like, he being the lore master on Elder Scrolls and everything, it was just like, I think he was already well positioned to be that guy, because he already
kind of makes sense,
because he already had that kind of firm grasp on like, he has like an encyclopedic grasp of Middle Earth, you know. Like, I don't know if he can speak Elvish or Black Tongue. I would love to.
I should have asked him when I spoke to him, actually.
Yeah.
That kind of makes sense, though, because if he was like the lore guy on the Elder Scrolls, and he probably studied a lot of Tolkien's work.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We did talk about Lord of the Rings when we did our podcast, so it would make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good to know.
It was funny because I think we had both left Bethesda by the time Rings of Power came out, but we had been chatting about it on a forum, and it was just kind of like, it was almost like we were almost one-upping each other on like who could become nerdier and like pull our pants up a little higher about like lore minutia.
Yeah. Well, there's some people that really know their stuff in regards to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me.
Our daughter's name is Arwen, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's awesome.
Well, I think it's kind of like the dwarves' names in The Hobbit, like Feely, Keely, all them. Like, they were actual names in Scandinavian lore. So Tolkien didn't invent those. He just took stuff that already existed. And I think Arwen is a actual Welsh name, like a really old, rare Welsh name. But there's Welsh on my dad's side of the family. So if she's ever like, why'd you give me such a nerdy name, Dad? I could be like, hey, don't hate your heritage, you know? I could guilt her into liking her name.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if he didn't make it, then obviously he helped popularize it.
Yeah.
And Peter Jackson probably helped that further. So
right.
So will Arwen, you'll make her watch Lord of the Rings at some point.
Yeah. She's already watched there's some stuff we skip because it's like a little intense for a toddler. Yeah. Like,
fair enough.
Like some of the Moria orcs are a little, they're either goofy or they're terrifying. Like the Moria orcs or the Misty Mountain goblins. We skip those, but
you know. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up your saloon that you worked on. Mm-hmm. I'll link some footage in the video, but I want to know how you came up with the idea of doing this Fallout saloon and Beckett's Bar. Because for those who don't know, like, you pretty much built a Fallout set, basically.
Yeah.
You decided to one up the Fallout show.
Yeah, it's like, I'll just put this right out front. Like, it's my favorite gaming universe. Like, there's always going to be a part of me that loves Fallout, that will always miss Fallout, that will always want to work on Fallout. There's like, I could have worked on Fallout until the end of my career. We have When I moved to Maryland, I got one of the things that decided me on this property was the garage, because the previous owner restored Cadillacs and it was an absolutely enormous 8-car garage with like a side garage added to it. And I thought I was gonna make like a prop shop for like my hobbies and everything. And I was always so busy with Bethesda stuff. I really never did. I never moved my shop out of the basement into that space. And a very, very good friend of mine lives in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is like 90 minutes from here. And he does lots of work on Vespas, and he's got a kit car of a 1929 Gazelle. And him and I became friends because he had a Vespa that was from 1974, and it was already Vault-Tec colored. It was the exact shade of blue with yellow trim on it. And like, we connected over Facebook, and I was like, you know, he's kind of like the granddaddy of steampunk. His name is Thomas Williford. And like, he's been big in the steampunk scene for like 30 years. He had a show called Steampunked. It was like a reality television crafting show where teams would compete to build steampunk stuff. And so we had built a Fallout Vespa together, where I went up to his place, and with my camera, I photo scanned the body. And then I had the 3D model of that, brought it home. And I built like rocket engines and like Brotherhood of Steel parts and like a plasma rifle, and we fitted it onto the Vespa, and that's how we hit it off. It was just like, as a joint, we bonded over a joint project, and
that's cool.
Yeah, and so he ended up losing. He had a garage in Harrisburg that he worked on his like motorcycles and Vespas and everything, and so he asked, hey, would it be possible to rent out a bay out of your garage? I go, okay. And he helped me clean it out. And he's like, and we were playing 76 together constantly. And that's how we kept in touch during lockdown. And we would always visit each other's camps and hang out. And we loved, Beckett was our favorite companion. And we realized we had a bunch of stuff lying around where we could build Beckett's bar. And that's how it started. Like, he moved his garage into one of our bays, and he's like, you know what, we should build some of that stuff, that some of the stuff that's in your camp from 76. I'm like, okay. So it started out as Beckett's bar, and every time we completed something, it'd be like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? And then it just grew, and like, because Beckett's bar in the game is this like boozy lemonade stand that you just move around your camp, and Beckett spawns at that, and it's what allows Beckett to spawn in your camp. And we built that. I think we tried to get it done for the 4th of July because my family was coming down. I just wanted to have a little bar for everyone to get their drinks at. And then every time we touched it up or added, like, everything we added made us want to add something else. And it started as something that was like maybe 8 feet long or 10 feet long. And it just ended up filling the entire garage. And it just grew and grew and grew, you know?
It's a pity you can't like make it into a big like attraction. You'd have to get permits, right? And you'd probably have to deal with licensing as well.
There'd be licensing issues, and I'd probably have to get, I don't know, if I were having people there, I would probably have to get insurance that I couldn't afford, you know?
It would be a big cost.
Yeah. I mean, at the moment right now, it's covered under my homeowner's insurance, but it's part of the garage, you know? Like, yeah. Our garage is only this little bit of it is a garage. And then the rest of it is this like Fallout / Deadwood Appalachian saloon, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I live about 40 minutes away from the Hobbiton set Lord of the Rings. And yeah, I pretty much get that every time I tell a Lord of the Rings fan that. But I remember speaking to one of the people there who works at the place and does the tours. Mm-hmm. And they pay like a big amount of money, I think, to Warner Brothers for like the licensing.
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, yeah. So like it's actually quite costly to run that place, which is why it's quite expensive to go there. So licensing, permits, and then obviously, yeah, insurance. And yeah, it would be a Herculean effort to go through all that.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I don't even know where I'd begin to do it. Like, I don't know if I'd approach Todd or ZeniMax or Microsoft. Like, I don't know what the chain of custody would be, you know?
Yeah. Like, do a lot of your old Bethesda colleagues, do they know about it? Have some of them seen it?
Yeah. So,
oh, cool.
This was great. When my daughter was born in spring of 23, my sister had her baby a week after ours, her first baby, and then my wife's best friend, who was her maid of honor in our wedding, had her baby like 2 weeks before. So we basically had three babies all born at the same time, and we didn't want to do a baby shower because they kind of suck. Like baby showers are awkward, where you have to open gifts in front of people and you're 9 months pregnant and all you want to do is use the bathroom and everyone else is having like a Chardonnay and you can't drink and it sucks. And so there's this new kind of social get together that's like kind of picking up steam, and it's called a sip and see, where you do it after the baby, where the baby is born and no one has to bring a gift. They your friends can come by, have a drink and go, "Hey, cute baby." You know, and we had a sip and like we had the sip and see for ours. We did for all three babies, and my brother-in-law works at Bethesda.
Still does, or he did at the time.
No, he still does.
Cool. His name's that's awesome.
Yeah, his name's Chris Cummings. I've known him forever, like since 97, since we worked together at Ion Storm. And when him and my sister got met and hit it off and got married, I couldn't have been happier. And so, you know, he came like a bunch of people from Bethesda. I think we had 60 people in the saloon for the sip and see. Yeah. We have Christmas parties out there if it's not too cold. But we have like birthday parties out there, like our friend Thomas, who built this with me, he turned 60. He turned 60 recently. I turned 50, and then my wife just turned 40. So we had these milestone birthdays, and then we just had a big party in the garage for each one, or in the saloon. So, you know, every time I wonder if anytime I start to second guess, like, should I have invested this much time and money in this? I'm like, I think about how much I get out of it. And like, you know, it's, you know, we've got arcade games in there. People come over. We've got a pool table. There's just always like, it's always just fun. And like, you know, I'm every time I start to wonder, I think back on it, or I look to the next get together, I go, yeah, totally worth it. You know?
I wonder what like Todd or Jonathan Nolan would think of it.
I don't know.
They probably love it.
Yeah, Todd could be hard to get a hold of. So I'm sure as you can imagine. I try not to bug him. But if he sees this and he wants to shoot us, if the show wants to have a shoot a scene out there, they're more than welcome, you know? So
yeah, yeah. Wow. If I ever get the chance to speak with him, I'll put it out there. As you mentioned, though, he is very hard to get a hold of.
Yeah.
I get a lot of requests for him, and I'm like, not much I can do, buddy.
I mean, he was hard to get a hold of when I worked for him, you know? I mean, it's understandable. The guy wears 51 hats, you know? So.
And even more probably now than did when you started. Because you started, I mean, did you start around about the... pre-production cycle of Fallout 4? Whereabouts were you?
Yeah, so I started there in 2012, and when I got there, all but maybe six other people were doing, they were in the DLC cycle for Skyrim. And I went, I started straight on Fallout 4 in pre-pro, and one of the first things I built, the first thing I built was the Red Rocket, based on Ilya Nazarov's concept. And so, yeah, that's how I got started there. It's always interesting when you go to a new company, the first thing that you'll hear, you can kind of tell the direction or the vibe of a company based on the first thing you hear a coworker complain about. And one of the things that I was hearing is that, hey, yeah, like Todd's not around as much. We missed Todd. And it was like, you know, he was very involved on, he was very, very involved in Fallout 4, but you know, the studio was occupying the second floor of the building. This was coming from people who had worked with him when BGS was like down in the basement, and like it was only like maybe 60 people. You know, it had grown a bit. I got there during a transition period of I think Skyrim wildly exceeded their expectations. They knew.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, like they, I think by the time the game was done, they knew they had a hit on their hands. I don't think they understood how big of a hit they had on their hands. So one of the pitfalls of success is the pressure to follow that up. And so, you know, there was a lot of pressure on Fallout, like Fallout 4 had to be a hit. And it was, you know, it succeeded. It was wildly profitable. But I think that also meant that Todd would be that his attention would be on everything, you know, and everyone wanted his ear, you know.
And that becomes harder as time goes on. And
he
becomes more involved. Yeah, I mean, you're pretty much echoing what everyone else has said is, as time's gone on, he's just got too many hats and you don't see him as much. Did you get to have any input in terms of the color palette of Fallout 4? Because obviously Fallout 3 has, I guess you could say, a brownish color palette.
Yeah, Fallout 3 is like the original Quake, which I don't mind. I love it. But no, I did not have any input on the palette. That was Istvan Pelli, the art director for Fallout 4. And like he established the aesthetic, and I was a huge fan of his artwork before I even knew he was an art director there. Like he had for the longest time a website called MovKup, like MovKup. I don't know if it's online anymore, but he always did this amazing hard surface stuff, and I remember chatting with Emil like in the mid aughts, and I'm like, oh my, have you seen this guy's work? He's like, yeah, that's our art director on Fallout. I was like I need to get work there right now. You know. So yeah, it was, yeah, that was all Istvan, I believe.
So what was your approach to the art then? This being your first gig at Bethesda, you being a huge Fallout fan already.
Right.
And obviously, with there being a ridiculous amount of pressure on Bethesda because of the success of Skyrim and to carry that on with Fallout,
mm-hmm.
How did that all, I suppose, affect the way you worked or your approach to your work?
I got really lucky where they let me conceptualize a lot of my stuff. Like I think I had a total of three concepts, or I worked off of a total of three concepts in Fallout 4. Red Rocket, and I can't remember the other two. No, one of them was the Yangtze, the submarine, and I think the other was some structural detail that was built along the side of a building. They gave me a lot of free rein with modeling things. And I did, I think I helped save on concepting time. But I would, I think it's because I was always brainstorming stuff in my free time. Like I had a little sketchbook with stuff that I wanted to do. And I did the vault kit. And I made a ton of content for the vaults, and I still had a ton of stuff left over that I really wanted to do. And it was just a matter of time where it was like, I had already spent an inordinate amount of time on the vaults. I had gone over budget on some things, and I messed up where I did the Yangtze exterior, and the Yangtze was supposed to have its own unique interior kit, but I had gone over time budget on the vaults because I couldn't leave it alone. Like I kept adding.
Oh, you became like obsessed with it. Oh, like very meticulous about it. Yeah.
And I way overscoped it. And unfortunately to the detriment of the submarine. So we had to end up using a different kit, and you know, it was a hard lesson. I came to Bethesda as a huge fan, and I was there for 10 years, and 10 years prior to that, I was at Epic. And a lot of the artwork that I did for Gears of War 3 was inspired by the art book of Fallout 3. So it became this like kind of recursive, this loop of inspiration, you know,
feedback loop. Yeah, it's a feedback loop of inspiration.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. There's a configuration. It's like an eight twisted eight shape. I'm trying to remember. It's like some kind of knot. But that was almost like it became this like loop, this inspirational loop. And with Gears of War, no matter how open an environment looked, it was still always a corridor. It just had like a lot of forced perspective. It was a very linear game. And Epic was also, and continues to be, in the business of licensing. So the better you make your game look, the more appealing it makes it to licensees. Like, hey, your game could look this cool. So the deadlines on Gears of War were like double, you know? And so I always had more time to make stuff for Gears. And so when I came to Bethesda, Bethesda was like way more fast paced, you know? And I had a hard time adjusting. I had a hard time keeping pace with things. I found the groove eventually, but like I couldn't overthink things for Fallout the way I could with Gears, because when you're making art for Gears, you're also advertising the engine. You know what I mean?
True. Yeah, that's something I never actually even considered.
It's like everything that was put into Gears had to look absolutely top notch. So if it meant taking a little more time, then that's what it took. And Bethesda operated very, very differently. They were, it's like the deadlines were a lot tighter, and the assets required were a lot bigger, because
it's an open world as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's an open world game. It's not a linear, you know, squad based shooter, you know.
So how long do you think it took you to kind of make that adjustment mentally into that different framework?
It took me the first game.
So like all of Fallout 4 you were trying to adjust.
Yeah,
how long was the development? It was like three years, 4 years? How long was Fallout 4 in development?
It shipped, yeah, so it was about 3 years. I got there in spring of 2012, or like early spring of 2012, and it shipped in fall of 2015. So over 3 years, I had to unlearn 10 years of I had made things a certain way for 10 years at Epic. And it took me about 3 years to kind of unlearn that. And also the creation kit, the creation kit is a very, very different beast from Unreal Engine.
I suppose the creation engine and the Unreal Engine are very different.
They're very, very different. The I definitely prefer Unreal, and I'm back in Unreal again at Bitreactor on our current project. It's a lot more user friendly, I think. I also think that it, when you have a base of licensees, you're constantly updating it and fixing it, because you have to cater to the needs of thousands of people. And with Creation Kit, it wasn't quite as flexible or user friendly. To me, a good tool is when I'm working on stuff like our props, or out in the when we were building the saloon. When you get into a groove and you reach for a tool, you don't think about the tool in your hand. You just know it, and you're just intuitively grabbing things and working with it. And I always felt that with the creation kit, everything felt very deliberate. Like I am opening a dialogue and searching a dialogue and finding the thing in the dialogue. And it's like with Unreal Engine, I was just kind of like, I could just zoom through it a little faster, you know, like I wasn't as aware of what I was doing, because I it was easier to be in a zone than it was with Creation Kit.
Right. You had to focus a lot more on what you were doing.
Yeah. And that's not, and again, that's just, that was my adaptation or lack of. Like, there are people who worked at Bethesda for a long time that they can make that thing dance. Like they can, like it is, I mean, that's not to knock the creation. It's very robust. I mean, if it weren't robust, you couldn't make Starfield. You could not make Fallout. You could not make Elder Scrolls, you know, but they are very, very different.
But I imagine it would have been updated as time went on as well.
Oh yeah. Like we got,
yeah.
The rendering changed completely between Fallout 4 and 76. Like 76 is when we started doing like PBR rendering, and rather than authoring textures in Photoshop, we were doing everything in Substance Painter. So,
and I suppose it was updated again for Starfield.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because obviously I remember having this chat with Nate, and he's like, "They should just move to Unreal."
I wish they would. I still play 76. Like I love that game. Like I have my character's like level 520 or something.
Oh my god!
But it was weird that game was simultaneously one of the most stressful projects I've ever been on, and then also one of my favorite. You know, like that. And in 2001, I was at a studio called Nerve Software down in Dallas or Mesquite. We were right up the road from id, and we worked with id, and Gray Matter was doing the single player portion of Return to Castle Wolfenstein, and then Nerve did the multiplayer version. And it was interesting because we were one of the first shooters to do the extraction shooter thing. And that was like 76, where we only had 6 months to put out a multiplayer game. And that was simultaneously one of the most stressful, crunchy projects. But man, was it fun when it was done. It was like 76 and Wolfenstein were games that I just... And I think 76, Return to Castle Wolfenstein, and Gears of War 3 were games that I just kept playing when they were done. Because the horde mode in Gears of War 3 was like crazy addictive.
It makes me wonder, because like obviously with Fallout 76, that would have been hell, because when it released, it got absolutely slammed, right?
Yeah, they should not.
And that's never a good thing, I think, for a creative person to get that much criticism, especially all at once, in terms of like, it's very hard to keep your morale up or energy up.
Yeah.
I suppose in some ways, but then I suppose on the other you can use it as fuel, like, okay, we're gonna fix this thing.
Yeah, I think there was Fallout 4 was so profitable, there was this real push to get another one out as soon as they could. And, you know, 76 is like at least twice as big. I've heard four times as big as Fallout 4. And it's also multiplayer, and they'd never done multiplayer before. And it's like,
yeah,
that's not something you approach lightly. That's not something you treat like a DLC. And I think 76 started, it was going to originally be a multiplayer DLC for Fallout 4. I think that's how it started.
Interesting.
Yeah, I could be remembering this wrong. Perky and Joel Burgess probably would remember better. That's my recollection of it. And the one of the things I did not agree with was the let the players be the NPCs, because let the players be the raiders. And I'm like, you mean trolls? No. And it's just like it just wasn't, if you're trying to complete like the game, like 76 had a quest, but if other players decide that they're just going to be raiders, they're not going to be doing the quest, and they're just coming into your camp and trashing your shit all the time, you're like, that sucks.
Which they will do. Of course they will.
Yeah.
Do.
And it's just like, I mean, to be fair, that's what raiders do. Raiders suck. And that's why they're fun in fiction. That's why they suck in real life. It's just like, no one ever says, hey, I want to be a Somali pirate, because Somali pirates aren't nice. But, you know, a Pirates of the Caribbean pirate is plenty of fun, you know? And so to say that we ship 76 with some rough edges is being extremely generous. Like a circular saw has rough edges. 76 was like a broken box of China, you know?
But what was the vibe like at the studio? Because you must have known what you were about to release was going to be highly criticized. Or were you just riding on your own, like, your high supply? Like, oh, it'll be all good, you know, all of our other games have been great.
No, it was grim, man. Like, I think a lot of us knew that, like, we have something really fun here, but we've got all this other stuff in there that's getting in the way. And there's... I think Wastelanders was the game that we should have shipped. Like, because Wastelanders is when we added the NPCs and the NPC quests and like the Brotherhood of Steel and the settlers, and that's when it became like the Fallout experience. And I that was 18 months after, so we shipped 76 in 2018. And then Wastelander shipped later the next year. And I kind of think that that's the game we should have shipped. You know what I mean?
Was there anybody trying to advocate to maybe delay it?
I heard there was, but if ZeniMax wants the game out, that's when the game's coming out. You know, it's deadlines are deadlines, and they're, frequently they're immovable, you know?
Yeah, it is unfortunate, because deadlines can tie into management or production timelines, and obviously with these things there's always curveballs and things you don't take into account, and something can come up with production that you didn't account for, and that can make things spiral out of control, I guess.
Right.
And then, like, if you do release something by a deadline and it's not up to a certain standard, it can actually tarnish the reputation of that brand.
And then
you have to spend a whole bunch of money and time to repair that brand that reputation.
Man, it can take a lifetime to build a reputation. It can take you 5 minutes to destroy one, you know? Yeah, and it's I think that 76 cost Bethesda a lot of goodwill, which is why they did extend the deadline for Starfield. Like, Starfield shipped later than it was supposed to, and I think a lesson had been learned from 76 that you know, shipping something far before it's ready is not worth the hit. I think Shigeru, it was Shigeru Miyamoto, said that, like,
you know, it's a delayed game, a rush game is, I forget the quote, yeah, exactly, it's something like a rush game is bad, like a delayed game is
takes you a little more time, but a bad game, a rushed bad game is forever.
Yeah. I want to find the direct quote now.
Yeah.
I feel like I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I know I'm butchering it, but it's...
Yeah, I'm butchering paraphrasing it too.
You know?
Yeah. But, I mean, it makes sense to me then why they'll take so long on Elder Scrolls 6.
Yeah.
Because that's like the number one IP, right? And Skyrim is like so huge that they can't risk like... tanking the IP. I mean, even with the amount of money that they made off it and like how prestigious Elder Scrolls is, I would not expect them to like release it
right
before it's ready.
Yeah, I like to think that 76 laid down on the barbed wire for these other projects, you know.
Yeah. In some ways it may be a good thing.
Yeah, we cleared the minefield by stepping on every one of them, you know.
Yeah. This is the quote here. A delayed game is eventually good, but a rush game is forever bad.
There you go.
That's the quote that we both butchered.
Yes. So. That should be... I think every studio should have that embroidered into a pillow. And that pillow should be in the break room of every studio.
Yeah. I imagine that's only going to become more of a problem because obviously game development is becoming so expensive now. Expensive.
It's...
that like they won't even risk delaying anything because will they make their money back even if they delay it? It's hard to know.
They cost so much money to make now, and like, what, not every game has to be photorealistic, not every game has to have, you know, the slickest graphics, but AAA games almost always do. Quad A games have to, even AA games, you still have to have a high quality bar. And I think about when I started in game development, what it took to get an asset into a game versus what it takes now to get an asset into a game. The time and expectations are exponentially greater, you know?
And a lot of that cost is art.
It's
right.
It's a lot of it's art.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Because it takes so long.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me wonder about Fallout 5.
Yeah.
Well, one, they wouldn't have started it yet. It'll probably be in like early concepting stages, I imagine.
I think, yeah, I don't know any. I wish I knew more about Fallout 5. I miss, there's a lot of things that I miss about working on Fallout. At the same time, it's nice to be just a player again, you know?
Well, yeah, because you won't know how the sausage is made with Fallout
5. Yeah, now I just...
So you'll be able to enjoy it as a player.
I just put the sausage in a bun and relish and mustard and, you know, I enjoy every bit of it. I don't have to worry about what it... I don't have to worry about, like, the raccoon meat content of the sausage anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So,
So if with Fallout 5, whenever it does happen... if we're both still alive by then, hopefully.
Yeah.
What would you like to see in it?
I'd love to see vehicles. I'd love to see more power armor. I loved the camp building and settlement stuff, and like it was workshop. It was called workshop in Fallout 4, and then we called it camp in 76. And I love like more of that. Like I love the building stuff, and like if there was a vehicular component to it, I think there's a game out there called Crossfire. I think that's kind of a post-apocalyptic Mad Max-y game, but if they had like with the shipbuilding and everything that's in Starfield, I'd love to see something like that, but with like, I'd like to see like a really robust power armor construction system, a more robust buildings built like settlement building system, cars and trucks and things that go would be cool. You know, those would be the things I'd love to see.
I wonder if, as a fan.
Yeah.
I mean, I also wonder if there'll be a bit of a feedback loop from the Fallout TV show where there are things from that will end up influencing parts of the game. I mean, because I think they're doing 5 seasons of the Fallout TV show.
They're doing that? Wow. So, okay. I knew that they were...
That's what I heard. So I don't know.
I knew that as soon as the show started, they got renewed for a second season. And then I thought I heard something about a third season. I didn't know it was as many as 5.
I think the whole idea is to have 5, but I think currently it's planned at 3, but then they do want to do 2 more. I do feel sometimes some shows, they just go for too long.
Right.
Like, you don't need to have, like, 10 seasons or something, because you end up with padding, I feel, like filler.
Yeah, I think 5 seems to be the sweet spot. When I think about perfect television shows where I wouldn't change a thing about them, I think about The Wire. I think about Boardwalk Empire. I think about Breaking Bad. And those are all about that same length. I felt like The Sopranos went on a little too long. And that last... Now, there were also issues with, like, James Gandolfini needing a lot of time off. Because of his, I guess, depression issues, where they kept, there was a lot of start, if I recall, there was a lot of starting and stopping with The Sopranos. And The Sopranos, I felt like, had been a perfect show up to a certain point. And then those last 2 seasons, each episode is still television perfection, but how it came together, because they were like cut in half with like a year and a half hiatus in the middle. It just felt weird. But The Wire had a perfect 5 season arc. I think Boardwalk Empire did too. And when those shows ended, I was ready for them to be done. Like I felt like every main character, the arc of every character had been explored, you know, and the times or the time that they were exploring, because they were period pieces, where Boardwalk was. I'm like, I don't know how much more of that time you could tell. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I actually think you can probably apply that to some games as well.
Yeah.
Like, you can play some games and you're like, this game's a bit too long.
Like, yeah.
You can feel like that they're like padding it out, like putting in filler stuff.
I felt that way about Alien Isolation. Like, Alien Isolation, man, that game was so good and it was so scary. And it, to me, it was the Alien sequel that I wish Alien Earth was. like Alien Earth has its fans, but I think I need to revisit it. But I kind of bounced off of it by the second halfway through the second episode. I was just like, meh. But Alien Isolation was so good, and it felt so complete. It was an 8 to 10 hour game that felt like it was twice. Like, that game could have been 4 hours long or 5 hours long, and it would have been perfect. But I think that there's this expectation that when you spend $60 on a game, you're going to get an 8 hour experience, whether or not the scope of the game is justified. You know, like, I don't think that it should have been 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever it was.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There is like this, I suppose, this viewpoint that like if I'm paying $70 for a game, like it needs to be this many hours.
Yeah.
But there's, I mean, if a game's short as well, there is replayability a lot of times.
Right.
If it's a shorter game, then you might replay it, as opposed to like there's some massive like RPG that's like a 100-hour, 200-hour game.
I know that if it came down to if a player was annoyed annoyed with me for one of two reasons. I know which reason I'd pick. If one was, yeah, I was playing this game for like 17 hours and I just kind of zoned out and I forgot and I kind of quit. And then there's the other player who is, man, I was loving this game and then it ended, WTF, where I want more. I'm like, I'm gonna want that. Like, I'd rather have the player that's pissed at me that the game that loved the game I made and then
wanted more of it,
as opposed to the other one who was just kind of like, yeah, I played it and I played it and I played it and then just kind of like, what am I doing again? You know, like, and then just got annoyed by the experience and tapped out, you know?
Yeah, and increasingly, like, there's so many open world games now, and like, they're so big and so large, and people only have a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
That it's, I would think it would become increasingly harder to hold their attention.
Oh,
because
yeah.
You'd really have to stand out. That's why I'll be very interested what they do with Elder Scrolls 6. Like, I always feel like Fallout, for example, like it's its own unique thing.
Right.
There's like nothing else like Fallout.
No.
But increasingly, like, would say like fantasy games like Elder Scrolls 6, Witcher, Kingdom Come, Zelda,
Elden Ring.
You know, Elden Ring. Yeah. So it's becoming harder to stand out. Like with Skyrim was ahead of its time, right? Mm-hmm. And it was really doing stuff that hadn't been done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's going to be a tough challenge.
Yeah. The fantasy genre is pretty saturated. And so it's like, even, I mean, Bethesda has the example of deep love and fandom and brand recognition. But even then, you still have to deliver. Like, if you want to maintain that fandom, if you want to maintain the stature of that brand, like, you really got to deliver. And that, I can't imagine what the pressure of that is like.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably go as far to say it's probably the most anticipated game of all time behind GTA 6.
Oh, probably. I would believe it. You know?
Yeah. So whether they're up to the challenge, I don't know, the expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, even with Rockstar with GTA 6, I mean, that's a crazy amount of pressure as well.
Yeah, luckily, I think GTA 5 just prints money for Rockstar. I love GTA, but I love Red Dead Redemption, and my wife, like, that's her whole life. Like, her whole life is Red Dead and Westerns. You know, it's like, Red Dead Redemption 2 is such an amazing, polished experience to this day. Like, it came out the same year as 76, and it still looks incredible. And I can't wait to see what they do next with Red Dead. I just have no idea what I'm sure we'll see Fallout 5 before we see the Red Dead Redemption 3, you know?
Yeah, because you can only do one project at a time.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually important for creative people that they don't work on the same franchise all the time.
Yeah.
They switch it up so they're able to flex, I suppose, different creative muscles.
Yeah, that's mostly true. I found that when I was done with Gears of War 3, I was done with Gears. Like, I was like, I mean, there were cool things that I wanted to do, that I wanted to see done with it, but I knew that they weren't going to get done. Like, they did, like, I can't remember what there was something between Gears 3 and Gears 4. I can't remember the name of it. It was almost like, it was like the Gears equivalent of Halo ODST. But I kind of felt like I just felt like I was ready to do something else. I did not feel that way with Fallout. You know, I had done 4 and had gone through the Fallout 4 DLC cycle, and then had done Fallout 76, and like, I didn't really want to be moved off of the, I was moved off of the project onto Starfield. The time, I was the last artist at the Rockville studio still working on Fallout 76. Like, at that point, wow. it was everyone in Austin and me. You know, there was it's funny. There was a story about there was a Japanese at the long after World War II. I think the U.S. Army was surveying Pacific Islands for possible nuclear testing sites. And on one of those islands, they found like a Japanese soldier who didn't know the war was over. And he didn't know to not attack them. And it was like, I felt like that guy, like everyone had moved on the starfield. And I felt like I had been up in the hills still doing Fallout, you know, like everyone else. Like, I think a lot of Rockville was ready to do something else, but they were really wanting to get back.
Burned out?
I don't know if burned out, but they were really wanting to get on the Elder. Like, a lot of the artists were like chomping at the bit to get back to Elder Scrolls. And I was just like the one guy who was just like, no, give me more Fallout stuff to do. And they're like, yeah, we need people. We need more people on Starfield. But I'm like, but no, you know, I wanted to just, cause I was making content for the Atomic Shop, like power armors and furniture and everything. I could have kept doing that. Cause I loved playing 76, you know, in my free time. So I wasn't ready to quit, you know?
Like, no, you can't make me go.
Yes. I mean, once I was on Starfield, I was working under Matt Carafano, who he's the art director of Rockville, and he had been the art director on Skyrim. And I had never had, like, I always enjoyed chatting with him, but I had never worked with him before until Starfield. And he was great to work with. That was a really fun experience. And because he gave me tons of creative freedom. Like, he just let me, he let me make almost whatever.
Yeah, well, you made like a lot of different things for Starfield. It's on your website, right?
Yeah,
same with Fallout as well.
Yeah, it's I did like a lot of alien flora and like weird landscape stuff. I'm like, I want to make this weird Beksinski / Giger like fossil landscape, and it was just okay. I'm like, I wasn't anticipating him being so agreeable, and then he was.
And you're like, oh, awesome.
Yeah, if something was supposed to be nasty or Giger-esque or something like that, it was like, yeah, just give it to Josh, because I would do it all in ZBrush, and I love working in ZBrush. A lot of artists don't, because it's a very strange program, but yeah. No, I did a lot of vegetation. I did mostly hard surface stuff for Gears, but if there were like twisted trees and, you know, like odd flora, you know, I got to do it, and that was great.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got a few questions from my followers.
Sure.
For you. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can answer them.
Sure.
Maybe you cannot. We will see how we go. So this first one here is from R. Rodriguez 4991. How do they pull off transitioning between biomes so seamlessly in their games?
Because
it'd be an area you cover.
Right.
Like, I'm guessing one artist would cover one mm-hmm. area, and then like another artist might cover the next area that's deliberate, like directly next to it.
Yes. So things,
but there has to be a bit of transition between the two, doesn't there?
Yeah. So. And it's done. It's always done very well. I believe it's done procedurally, where the percentage of trees and plants and rocks that get placed gets, like, let's say you're in the mire in Fallout 76 with like the swampy area in the east. As you transition from that space down to the cranberry bog, I think it's like it it procedurally places fewer and fewer and fewer, and then more and fewer and fewer and fewer of one environment, and then more and more and more of the environment you're entering. I did not do any of that placement. I built the forest assets, like I built the trees and everything for the mire and a lot of other like plants that went in it, but I was not one of the landscape artists that placed everything. A lot of stuff gets placed procedurally, and then an artist goes back in and then fixes it cell by cell by cell. Like if I had to dumb it down, a cell is almost like a square acre, you know? And so acre by acre, an artist goes through and like tweaks the placement of everything, because the engine's never just gonna place the assets perfectly. And you know, you just get some really talented landscape artists that go in and, you know, not only fix the arrangement, like sometimes things are clipping weird, but they'll go in and like they'll just like make the composition of everything really nice too, you know.
That's good to know. Cool. All right.
Oh, and one other thing that helps is there's a post. I forgot. I have to add this because I forgot. There's a post-processing transition. So the like.
What does that mean exactly?
So the post-processing is when you're in a particular area, certain effects and colors render to the screen. Things are tinted a certain way, like the ash heap is very desaturated. The mire was very orange. The cranberry bog was very red, and some of that gets tinted on the screen. There, you kind of fade out some of that post-processing, and then ramp up the post-processing effects of the next area. So it's
gotcha.
It's a very layered approach, and it's one of the things that I think that I felt that with 76 they really nailed it, and that was definitely perky.
I wonder if that's quite common, like if that's the same sort of process a lot of other open world games would implement in terms of like their biomes.
I don't know. They might. I know that they do that in Elden Ring, like going from Altus Plateau, which is very fall like. There's like a lot of golden colors, a lot of like fall, a lot of very autumn and gold colors. When you go that into the like land of giants or that frozen area, like the post-processing kind of shifts a little bit. Everything gets, you know, you're not only rendering actual snow, but like, you know, the colors are just tinted a little cooler, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, next one. This is from the Exile AC. Were there ever talks for a handcrafted smaller galaxy or world for Starfield in pre-production?
I don't know. I knew very little.
About... Well, you're still working on Fallout, like, probably.
I had been on 76 for years after everyone transitioned onto Starfield. I knew almost nothing about it once I got on it, you know.
So was it like kind of like a sink or swim thing for you then when you just got dropped into Starfield and we're like, wait, what's going on? What are we doing here?
I wouldn't say it was sink or swim. It was just kind of like at the same time, I had no idea what was happening. It was just kind of like, just tell me what you want and I'll make it, you know, like, you know, just like sometimes there were concepts for it. And other times it was just like, go nuts. I only ever really knew the area I was working on. I haven't had a chance to play it. I know shockingly little about Starfield. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Yeah. Hey, you're extremely busy. It's actually it is quite surprising and amazing and humbling, I suppose, in a way, because it makes me feel less bad as well. But like, a lot of game developers don't actually get time to play a lot of games,
right?
And some of them are so burned out from making games that they get home and they're just like, oh, I'm done. You know,
that happens. That's been my case only since our daughter was born. Like, the last game I finished was Elden Ring, and that was right before she was born. I started playing Shadow of the Erdtree, but my PC, they made all these upgrades to the renderer, and my PC couldn't hang. The only other game I've played was helping playtest Perky's Axis Unseen, and even then, I only got like 7 hours into it. Like, I haven't gamed at all in 2 years. But it doesn't stop me from buying games on Steam, you know.
It's like, yeah, a lot of people do. Yeah.
My Steam library keeps growing and growing and growing, but she's only, like, my daughter's 2.5, she's only going to be this small once, you know, and we're not having another kid, and so it's kind of like I've gamed all my life. I'm like, I can, like, I don't mind pumping the brakes on gaming to enjoy this facet of life. But it's like, you know, if I do game at all, it's like an hour or two here and there with my friend I built the saloon with in 76, you know. But I haven't started a new game. Like Axis Unseen and Elden Ring were the last games I played.
Well, you're not alone, because I hear this often.
Yeah.
About devs, like, not being able to play a lot of games and buying a lot of games on Steam and then just not playing them. Well, I think a lot of actual consumers just do that anyway, because I just know a lot of people that buy games on Steam and then they just never play them.
The one game I was addicted to, and it's still one of my favorites, is Shadow of Mordor, and then the sequel Shadow of War, like the Middle Earth games. Those were so good. I'm looking forward to revisiting those, and I'm looking forward to playing Red Dead some more. It's not one of those things where I've not outgrown games. I haven't quit games. I'm just
busy.
Priorities
are different.
Yeah. It's on a very, very, very temporary hiatus, you know?
Yeah. And that makes sense. And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Final question here. This is from Malkethius Record. If you were to define your work time in a pie chart, how much would you split your efforts from designing, studying, general modeling, or texturing in office like meetings or feedback?
That depends on the studio.
True. Good point.
I won't go into meetings, because I think Perky already covered that at length.
Yeah, he covered that pretty substantially.
There's nothing I could say that he hasn't already said better. Most of my time is spent modeling. And I love 3D modeling. I love doing hard surface stuff. One of the things that I preferred about Epic was I was hired at Epic as a level designer. And I was a level designer who could do art. And then I was hired at Bethesda as an artist who could do level art. When I was at Epic, my time was like evenly mixed. I could do my own multiplayer levels and then do the art for them. Bethesda was a bit more compartmentalized, a bit more structured, where it was like, you're going to be doing level design or you're going to be doing art. Now you could do the level art, like you could place, like you can go, you are welcome to go in and place things, but I think in the earlier days of Bethesda, when it was a lot smaller, you had that freedom to kind of do one thing and then another. But yeah, as it grew,
you did.
I mean, and it's not a knock on the studio. How do you keep something like that on the rails? Is it requires more organization. And so there is unfortunately some pigeonholing that comes with that. But like, in answer to your question, like I would have easily done half of my pie chart would have been level design and the other half would have been modeling, you know, but these days it's mostly modeling.
Yeah. And it's just the nature of AAA development.
Yeah.
as a team gets bigger, everything gets more fragmented.
Smaller teams, and BitReactor is my current studio is at a really, really good size, where we're big enough to see through a Star Wars, like the expectations of a Star Wars game are always sky high, and Lucasfilm is always checking to make sure you're meeting their quality bar. But when you're at a studio this size, it's kind of an all hands effort. So you can do a little bit more. Like if you want to do some level design, no one's going to say no. Like if you want to do, if you can do art and you can help out, more the merrier. You know, it's just it has not, and I hope it does not reach that size where everyone just goes to their stall, puts their blinders on, goes to that particular stall, and that's all they do. I hope it doesn't reach that scale, and I can't imagine it getting to that scale, given the culture of the studio.
Given how much of a Star Wars fan you are, mm-hmm. are you going to play Outlaws at some point?
Yes, I bought it. Like I have like bad.
Oh, you've okay.
I bought it. I just haven't. I may have even installed it, but like I just haven't gotten into it. Played. I loved Battlefronts, like because I was a huge man. You take Battlefield, taking the Battlefield universe and then Star Wars vehicles, like you can't lose. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I loved Battlefronts.
It's a pity they won't go back to it now, but all good things come to an end, I suppose.
I mean, they might. They might, but.
Well, didn't EA lose a lot of money on Battlefield or Battlefront 2?
I don't know. I don't know what was.
And there was some controversy.
I mean, it might have. I don't. Well.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. The industry is just in a weird place.
Yeah.
That's all. So you hear about controversies all the time. It's like crunch, bad management. Yeah, those are like the main things. Layoffs. That's those three. Those seem to be like the three things you hear about all the time in the industry.
Yeah.
And you don't, and it sucks because you don't really hear about all the positive stuff. It kind of gets clouded by all the bad stuff.
Yeah. I have such a weird relationship with game development where back to the pie chart. It's like my pie chart is mostly love. And then there's that one small sliver of it that's absolute hatred where I'm like, well, if Walter White can cook meth, why can't I, you know, you know? And then, but it's usually when I'm stressed out about something and like, but it's like, when a level comes together and the lighting is just right, that's great. And then when you put your game out and players love it, they're like, oh yeah, that's why I do this. You know, that's why I'm not cooking meth. You know, it's like, you know, I think one of the most gratifying, one of the things that was really, one of probably some of the most gratifying feedback I ever got was, Return to Castle Wolfenstein shipped in 2001, and it was shortly after we deployed to Afghanistan, and we got the nicest email from some soldiers who were living out of a storage container in Anbar province or something like that, and it's like at the time things had been called for, like they're a whole. Their whole life was just, it was a nonstop LAN party of Wolfenstein. And it was just like photos of these guys in this like shipping container with all their PCs. And it's kind of like, you know, when we're not scared to death, we're playing this, you know, when we're not cold in the mountains and missing our families, we're playing this, you know? And when I play 76 and I see players who are like level 1,000 or 1,200, anyone in a 4-digit level rank to a T, anyone that I've talked to, absolutely every one of them has some kind of disability where they're like, this is my life, this is what I do, that's why I have the time to hit level 1000. And some of them are like wounded vets, some of them are people with just like debilitating conditions they were born with, and that's just the hand they were dealt. And the fact that, like, the fact that 76 in Wolfenstein or Gears or whatever you do, that if it brings them that kind of happiness, I'm like, oh yeah, that's why we crunch, that's why we do this, you know.
Wow, that's really touching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one story.
Okay. Well, tell me the last story.
Sure.
It'll be a good way to wrap up.
Yeah. And this was, I can talk about it now because everyone's dead. I don't like it when people do I don't want to say charity, or like when they do something nice, but make sure everyone on the internet sees it. You know what I mean?
That kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, yeah. Like TikTokers who are like putting a homeless guy on the spot with like, here's the sandwich I bought you, here, show your gratitude. And they're like, okay. You know, I mean, that's gross. Like, I don't like that. But it's just like, one thing that happened during Fallout 4 was, there was a fan who was in my friends list on Facebook, and he was always commenting on Fallout, always super nice, always really supportive. And then I'm laying in bed, my wife and I are laying in bed, and I get this message from him, and he goes, I'm dying, can you make me a Fallout helmet? Can you make me a Brotherhood of Steel helmet? Because I was making the Brotherhood of Steel prop helmets. And I messaged him back, I'm like, I didn't know if he was like drunk posting or what. I'm like, his name was Corey. I go, what's this about, man? You okay? And he never got back to me, and he's engaged. And so I messaged his fiance. I'm like, hey, your fiance sent me this, sent up a screenshot of it. I'm like, what's going on? Is he all right, or what's the deal? She's like, no, he had a condition where his organs were failing, and he was like in his early 30s. Like, he's like, yeah, he's in hospice care. And I'm like,
oh my God.
I'm like, oh shit. And so I made, the props usually take me a while to make. I, with the help of my wife, my then fiance, we put together a helmet in about 3 weeks, like fully painted and everything. And the marketing department of BGS just threw in like 50 pounds of swag, and I sent it to him, and he sent me back, or his fiance sent me back, a photo of him sitting up in his bed wearing the helmet in hospice, and then he died a week later. And I was like, man, I'm glad I did that. And then I became friends with his brother, and we chatted on and off, and I stopped hearing from him during lockdown. And I was like, I wonder how Chris is doing. I haven't heard from him in a while. And I found out that he had died in some freak car accident. And both of the parents, like the mother had died years ago, and then between when Corey died and his brother died, the father died. So the family is extinct. And the helmet, I don't know whatever happened to it. And then about 2 years ago, someone pings me again on Facebook. He's like, I bought this thing. So Corey lived in Tennessee, and this guy from Indiana, like, I think it's Gary, Indiana. He's like, I got this thing at a flea market, and it has your name in it. And it's the Brotherhood helmet, but it had been broken. He's like, could you fix it for me? I was like, sure. And so it had made, I don't know how, but this thing had made its way from Tennessee to Indiana. You know, I'm like, I was happy to give it to him, but then I told him the backstory. I'm like, I hope this thing isn't cursed, you know? So, because it had gone, wow. Yeah, it had gone from Corey to his brother Chris, and then Chris died, and then it traveled upstate to Indiana, and I don't know how. But that was, it was almost like this like monkey's paw,
Wow. What an emotional story. I was getting quite emotional listening to it. That's really, really, that's a really cool story. I suppose he still has it?
He still has it, yeah. And he made a display case and he keeps it in his living room. So I'm like, well, that's cool. But it's just like, that's awesome. I wanted to keep that story to myself because I didn't want to like embarrass Corey or his family, but they're all gone. They're all gone, you know? So
it's a touching story though.
Yeah.
And yeah, just it lends more weight to what you're saying in terms of the gravity of what you do.
Yeah,
and how it impacts people.
Yeah, and it just,
and so I can understand why people put themselves through so much crunch and like all the layoffs and like the uncertainty of the industry and stuff, because that type of reward for doing that would be, well, it'd be worth more than any amount of money,
right?
You know,
yeah, it's
status.
I'm very fortunate. Like I've worked on plenty of games that never sold, but I've never worked on a bad game. And not only have I not worked on a bad game, I've had the very, very good fortune of being on games that were either had a huge fan base or generated a huge fan base, you know?
Yeah.
So that's gratifying.
Well, that's a beautiful place to wrap up.
Yeah.
Josh, this has been an absolutely huge pleasure. Long time coming.
Yeah.
What, 8 months to make this happen, but yeah. I'm glad we finally did it.
Thank you for being patient.
That's all right. Yeah. That's all right. Hey, it's no problem. Mm-hmm. You got to do what you got to do, man. Right. So I much appreciate it. And I'd love to do this again sometime.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe we can review Fallout 5 together whenever that comes out.
Yeah.
In 10 years? Who knows? But yeah, this has been great, man. So if anyone wants to keep up to date with any of your artwork or anything that you're doing, mm-hmm. is there somewhere they can go to do that?
Yeah, it's joshuajart.com. And then we have our YouTube channel, when we only have one so far, but it's Double J Studios on YouTube, or if you just search out like Fallout Saloon Josh J, you know, you'll get the whole tour, and it's a whole tour. It's a 20-minute making of, you know.
It's great, by the way. I highly suggest people check it out, especially if you're a Fallout fan. Like a lot of effort went into that. So
yeah, and we're gonna have more stuff. We're gonna be doing like more videos. We're gonna do like prop building, like cool. Fallout like helmet props, and yeah.
Well, I hope it does well.
Yeah,
I hope it takes off.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks, man.
No worries. Cool. All right. Well, there's the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe. Yeah.